Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Matt Niederman for the appellants and the plaintiffs below. Your Honor, by way of introduction, also with me at counsel's table is my colleague Gary Lipkin.
Welcome.
Your Honors, this appeal deals with the question of what are the proper sanctions for the filing of pleadings with an improper notarization. And the primary question presented is whether, under the facts of this case, dismissal, the extreme remedy of dismissal, was the appropriate sanction, and a dismissal as to both plaintiffs as to all of the claims. I think three corollary questions are presented with this appeal, Your Honors. The first is whether the court considered the factors necessary to determine that dismissal was an appropriate sanction in this case, including whether lesser sanctions would have been appropriate under the circumstances of this case. Second is whether the court properly dismissed claims as against a plaintiff who was specifically found not to have engaged in any wrongdoing. And finally, whether the court independently, under any standard, should have considered lesser sanctions, and it's reversible for a failure to have done so. I'd like to begin, Your Honors, by briefly reviewing what I believe are a few of the important facts that bear on whether dismissal was an appropriate sanction in this case. And then I will address our three arguments that we've raised, the argument as to whether the appropriate standards were considered, the argument as to whether findings of the court, regardless of the standard, constitute an abuse of discretion in terms of finding dismissal, and finally, whether dismissal of claims as against Mr. Bissigne was warranted under any standard. The factual background, Your Honors. This case was a stockholder action brought up against a company called Vermilion, Inc. It was in context of a proxy contest for two contested board seats of Vermilion. The plaintiffs brought this case seeking to restore one of those two board seats, which was taken away on the eve of a very contested election of directors at a time when plaintiffs alleged and believed that defendants understood that they were likely to lose both seats if the election were to go forward. The relief sought by plaintiffs in this case, Your Honors, was not monetary. The plaintiffs were seeking to allow all of the Vermilion stockholders the ability to vote on both of the seats that were up for election on a staggered board of directors. The election was contested in part because of the poor performance of the company since it emerged from bankruptcy in 2010. The litigation below was expedited, with fact discovery being largely completed, and it was on the eve of trial. Plaintiffs had submitted their pretrial brief, and the motion to dismiss was filed shortly before defendants were due to file their pretrial brief. The court below ultimately ordered dismissal pursuant to Rule 41B after finding that the notarizations filed with pleadings in the case and interrogatory answers were done improperly because the person who notarized the verification, the person who signed the verifications, didn't personally appear before the notary who notarized them. To be clear, Your Honors, the appellants are not arguing that in this case that the notarizations were done correctly. Plaintiffs acknowledge that they were not correct under Pennsylvania law and are not trying to justify that they were correct under Pennsylvania law.
Well, in Pennsylvania, that would be a serious concern and violation. That would it not subject a complaint to dismissal in Pennsylvania?
I'm not certain that it would, Your Honor.
It has in the past?
I think it has in the past, yes, Your Honor, under, I would argue, different circumstances. And what I would say is I think there are a few facts about the notarizations in this case that bear on the answer to that question that I'd like to make clear if I could. One, this isn't a case where the notarizations were done to present a false signature or that somebody just handed a signature and said, hey, notarize this, and nothing was done. In this case, the facts are uncontested and unrebutted that the notary, Ms. Bennett, was asked whether she could do the type of notarization, whether she could do a notarization remotely. She then did some research on her own and went and consulted with a colleague who was a more senior notary, determined that she could under an exception under Pennsylvania notary laws. She then got a copy of the signature. She asked for and obtained a copy of the identification of the person who was signing the documents. She got on the phone with that person to confirm that, in fact, that was his signature. that he intended to sign the documents, and got a licensed attorney in Pennsylvania to confirm for her that he was who he said he was. In other words, and in fact, there's no dispute. The signatures were his. He read the documents. He intended to sign them. He did sign them. He participated in this case as a plaintiff. He's appeared here for depositions. In fact, what we have, and I think what the court's finding below was, that it was wrong. And I think from the record below, Ms. Bennett believed in good faith that what she was doing was correct, but in fact it wasn't. And I think that distinguishes this from cases where there is intentional wrongdoing with respect to a notarization. Now, if I may, and I think those are, Your Honors, the key facts that bear on whether under these circumstances dismissal was a proper sanction. So I'll turn now to address each of the arguments in turn that we've raised. First, did the court below apply the proper standards in deciding to dismiss the case as against all parties? I think the standard of review in terms of whether the court applied the correct standard, that question is de novo.
What is the standard as enunciated by this court?
The standard as enunciated by this court in terms of whether the court properly dismissed a case, that is, whether applying the facts to the standards is abuse of discretion. In terms of the proper standard that applies, it would be de novo. In other words, deciding as between should standard A or standard B apply, what are the factors that you would look at? I think another interesting question is, Your Honor, I don't think there is much guidance, if any guidance, from this court as to what those factors are that a court looks at in deciding a 41B dismissal. What I would say is the best sort of thorough analysis of it was in the Post-Arrivo case where Vice Chancellor Parsons looked to several jurisdictions and ultimately followed some guidance from, I believe, the Fourth and Ninth Circuits in saying, I think these are the factors that a court should look at in deciding whether a 41B dismissal is appropriate. I don't think this court has weighed in on that question as to whether those are the correct standards under Rule 41B.
Well, what standard was argued below?
The Parfee standard was argued below. And that standard followed a decision by Chancellor Strine looking at the single question of whether an intentional fraud on the court warranted dismissal. Now, interestingly, Your Honors, when Chancellor Strine looked at that question, he was literally only looking. There had already been a determination that there was a fraud on the court, that a party knowingly gave false facts to the court to lead the court to believe that the reason an arbitration hadn't been pursued was that he lacked the funds to do so, and therefore a stay should be lifted. In that case, the court was only looking at is this a fraud on the court? Does it warrant dismissal? And was it done to gain a strategic advantage, which are two of the factors that are enunciated in Post-Arrivo and other cases. And the court ultimately concluded that dismissal was warranted. Now, interestingly, that court in Parfee also looked at whether alternative remedies or alternative sanctions would have been appropriate in that case. So it actually looked at a third part of that standard in saying, I don't think alternative remedies are warranted here, and went on to talk about what they might be and why they weren't an appropriate sanction in that case, which is one of the things we argue didn't happen in this case, Your Honors. In Post-Arrivo, the court ultimately...
Let me understand you on this. Are you contending today and in your briefs that a different standard should have been used than what you argued today? Therefore, it's plain error that requires reversal. And yet you conceded that this court has not enunciated a standard. So how can it be plain error?
What I would say is, Your Honor, it's plain error because the only authority that exists as to what the proper standards are, even though it's not from this court but from the same court, is the analysis that's laid out in Post-Arrivo, which is the analysis gleaned from looking at what numerous jurisdictions around the country have done. And what I would say is, and to the point of the standard that got argued below, what I would say is this. The only argument that got presented for dismissal was a Parfee fraud on the court. We believed, and apparently incorrectly, that what was being submitted to the court below was that this is the same type of fraud on the court as in Parfee, and therefore it's the fraud on the court standard in Parfee that should be looked at and decided. What I would say then is the appellees have said in their answering brief now that they never explicitly made that argument to the court below. Therefore, the other 41B standards don't apply. But that's what we were responding to and arguing below. What I would say in addition to that is the court then went on to find that there was not intentional misconduct in this case. So our contention is that once the court determined that there wasn't intentional misconduct or a fraud on the court, as in Parfi, the court should have then looked whether as to whether these other factors warrant a dismissal under Rule 41B. The court also, and again, even in Parfi, the court looked at whether lesser sanctions would have been an appropriate remedy. And this court did not do that, even under the Parfi standard, which we believe alone is reversible error. The court in Postarivo went on to look at six factors in determining whether dismissal is appropriate under Rule 41B. The first was existence of extraordinary circumstances. The second is the presence of willfulness, bad faith, or fault by the offending party. The third is the efficacy of lesser sanctions. The fourth is the nexus between the misconduct and drawing the sanction and the matters in controversy in the case. The fifth, the prejudice to the party victim of the misconduct. And sixth, the government interests at stake. Your Honors, the court below ultimately concluded only whether there was fault, as to whether there was fault on the part of the party wrongdoer, and as to whether there was a strategic advantage gained. Those were the two factors the court below looked at. The court below did find fault. And I think the fault that was found is something akin to negligence. I think what the court found was that one of the plaintiffs, Mr. Goggin, should have known that the notarization process that was followed was incorrect. And then the court below then imputed that failure to know or failure to do more to the co-plaintiff, Mr. Bissigny. The court did not address, number one, the efficacy of lesser sanctions, which we submit as alone grounds for reversal. Second, the nexus between the misconduct at issue and the matters in controversy in the case. Or three, whether there was prejudice to the defendants below, the opposing parties. And again, I would reiterate that having not found that there was intentional misconduct or an intentional fraud on the court below, the court should have gone on and looked at whether any other standards warranted dismissal in this case. In particular, whether lesser sanctions should have and would have been a remedy. In fact, I would submit to your honors that neither the defendants below the appellees argued that lesser sanctions wouldn't have been a viable remedy in this case, nor did the court ever conclude that lesser sanctions would have been viable as a deterrent to improper notarizations. Second, your honors, assuming the court applied the correct standards when it determined dismissal, we respectfully submit that the court below abused its discretion in finding that dismissal was warranted in this case. As mentioned, the court below seemed to only analyze whether dismissal was proper under Parfi. Parfi was a case where Chancellor Strine looked at intentional fraud on the court, found affirmative fraud, ultimately ruling that that's what had happened there and that dismissal was appropriate. The fraud there involved deliberate and knowing misrepresentations of fact to the court, done specifically with the goal of gaining a strategic advantage, that is the lifting of a stay in that case. Here, the court declined to find a fraud on the court or intentional misconduct.
Well, wasn't there a deliberate misrepresentation that it was sworn to in the presence of the notary?
There certainly was a misrepresentation, so that jurat on that on the notarizations was wrong. It was false.
And it was intentional.
Well, I don't think the court found that, Your Honor.
Could it be anything but if everyone knew that it was not sworn in the presence of the notary?
Well, I think that the question was the notary believed in good faith that by taking the steps that she took, including speaking to him personally on the telephone and saying, "Is this your signature?" that satisfied that requirement under the jurat. I agree. It was those words were not true. So when she signed the notarization saying that personally appeared before me, whether she believed that the steps she took constituted that appearance for purposes of Pennsylvania notary laws, it was wrong. It was false.
Well, in preparing for this case and, you know, doing research on your for your brief, have you found a case anywhere in the country where you can talk to someone on the telephone and then notarize their signature?
I have not, Your Honor, no. And now, to be fair, in researching and preparing for this case, what we did determine is that a number of states have similar notarial laws, but there are a handful of states that have very different laws. Pennsylvania, for example, is one state that has the credible witness exception. I think there are seven states that recognize that. That's not an exception before this case that I was aware of. I wasn't aware of how that law applied. So there are differences in the laws in every state.
But does anybody have a telephone exception?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
This is pretty stark to notarize somebody's signature based on a telephone conversation.
Yeah, I would agree. It was the wrong way to do it, Your Honor. I mean, it was done incorrectly. And what I would say is, you know, again, I think the notary in this case, well, the other thing I would add about Pennsylvania law on notaries is, unlike Delaware, Pennsylvania attorneys aren't notaries. And so I think the court below found that Mr. Goggins should have known that the manner in which this was done was incorrect and shouldn't have relied on the notary, presumably, to determine that that was done correctly, and asked whether, in fact, as in the case in Delaware, a Pennsylvania attorney is a notary and therefore should have known. Under Pennsylvania law, in fact, attorneys aren't notaries. And so we respectfully submit that I would agree that more could have and probably should have been done, Your Honors. But I wouldn't say that he necessarily should have known, been familiar with Pennsylvania notary laws and the exceptions to the laws.
But he also knew that it was not sworn to personally before the notary and submitted it to the court.
Yes. He knew that Mr. Bisigna didn't personally appear before the notary, correct. And again, not trying to excuse that, that the notarizations were false, that the jurat was false, but I would point out that the court below didn't find that that was intentional misconduct, that there was a knowing fraud on the court, that there was an intent to deceive the court to gain a strategic advantage there.
At least one point, the Court of Chancery's Chancellor, Vice Chancellor, said that there was troubling conduct. What did he mean by using that phrase other than the fact that the affiant didn't personally appear before the notary and the notary knew that she was, in effect, notarizing a signature without that person having appeared before her? I got the impression there was more to this case than simply there was no fraudulent intent in doing that. It was a mistake, a serious mistake that violated Pennsylvania law and presumably a chancery rule. But this reference to troubling conduct, what else is there in the record that compounded that event to make the conduct troubling?
To be honest, Your Honor, I'm not sure. The only other thing I can think of, and this came out at questioning in the hearing below, is that the fact that the notary was employed by Mr. Goggin. So she might have felt some sense of pressure to give him the answer that, yes, I can perform this notarization in this way.
Well, I got the impression from reading the briefs that you've been very forthcoming this morning, but that not everybody was immediately forthcoming in the Court of Chancery, and things were a little protracted, and eventually everyone came around to where you are today. And that seemed to trouble the Vice Chancellor that everyone was not forthcoming immediately. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor. Yeah, I would agree. And in hindsight, I think there was a comment, I think, made in a hearing or something about the response or the approach to it seeming cavalier or something along those lines. And in hindsight, I can see how the court would have reached that conclusion. I think we were in a pretty hotly contested litigation, and the timing of when the motion got filed, which was after a key deposition and right after we had filed our pretrial brief and before the other one was due to be filed, we believed was an attempt to sort of distract from the merits of the case and in part approached our response to that motion in that way. In hindsight, it probably was the wrong approach to take with the court below, and so I could see how Vice Chancellor Noble drew that conclusion. And that's my fault, and I regret that we approached things that way. And that's why on appeal we're not arguing you know, the notarization was done correctly or that more couldn't or shouldn't have been done in this case, Your Honors.
Was part of the troubling contact or conduct the deposition testimony of one of the plaintiffs that he could not even remember being in the United States 2 weeks earlier?
Yeah, I think below the defendants below appellees made a big point of that. But the interesting thing was that then, I think the course of questioning was there was questioning about where he was on a specific day, and the witness kept saying, "Mr. Bissigny, I want to go back and review my records before I say definitively because this seems important where I was on this particular day." He was traveling a whole bunch in that time. He's a resident of Switzerland. He had traveled to the Caribbean and then to Puerto Rico and then eventually to the United States. And so he said, "I want to see my documents." But there was no question he wasn't in Pennsylvania. There was no question about that at the time he signed the notarization. What I would say is that
I have to let you know that your time is up, including your rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors. That's all I have.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Clayton Athey, appearing on behalf of the defendants, appellees. With me at counsel table is Peter Stone of Paul Hastings. The appellants have failed to show that the Court of Chancery abused its discretion by dismissing this matter as a consequence of their litigation misconduct.
Tell me what role, please, that our legion of cases which talk about Delaware's preference to hear disputes on the merits play, if at all, as a matter of policy in the way in which this case was resolved.
Your Honor, I think Delaware certainly does have a policy for hearing cases on the merits, but this is a slightly different case than is usual. We're talking about a threshold issue of a requirement that the pleading, the complaint in the action, be filed with a verification made under oath. And the plaintiffs in this case didn't even get past that threshold requirement without the misconduct that we've discussed in our papers. So here we're not talking about an issue that where litigation had been ongoing for a long time, and in the heat of litigation, a mistake was made with respect to the rules. This was a fundamental threshold problem.
I understand that point. You used the word misconduct. The court used the phrase troubling conduct. We seem, at least in the initial argument, to have at least one set of parties' position that there was no fraud. So when you use the term misconduct, what do you mean by that, if you mean more than a good faith mistake?
Your Honor alluded to the troubling conduct previously, and it's more really than just the submission of the improper verifications. We learned of this issue after the June 12, 2012 deposition of Plaintiff Bissigny, and he gave us quite a few answers that were misleading and contradictory. That really is the reason that we identified this as an issue at all. And it was only after that deposition that we contacted the Plaintiff's Counsel and asked for additional information about how these verifications had been executed. And plaintiff's counsel was not forthcoming with information. And we were forced to resort to motion practice and discovery in order to uncover exactly what had happened. So it was within that context that we learned that Mr. Bissigny, on the very day that this litigation was filed, May 25th, 2012, with his co-plaintiff, Mr. Goggin, had identified a notarization problem, and they had emailed their counsel about it. And the solution that they arrived at was that they would Mr. Goggin would cause his legal assistant, Ms. Bennett, in Philadelphia to notarize the initial complaint verification without requiring the presence of Mr. Bissigny. Mr. Goggin, I think the court found, if he didn't know, he certainly should have known. It is a point of law that's not one that's terribly complicated, that an affiant needs to appear before a notary for that notarization to be valid. And we cited case law, and the court cited case law, saying that it is clearly unlawful in Pennsylvania for a notary to notarize a document without the presence of the affiant. So Mr. Goggin, who's an attorney...
Is there a basis for dismissal in Pennsylvania?
Had this occurred before a Pennsylvania court, we cited the Bolas case that finds that improperly notarized complaints are subject to dismissal in Pennsylvania, and we believe the same standard should apply in Delaware.
That's not a direct answer to Justice Risley's question. You said subject to dismissal. As I read his question is, would it have been dismissed under Pennsylvania law?
We believe under these facts, yes, Your Honor, it would have been dismissed under Pennsylvania law as well. We believe that Pennsylvania, like Delaware, holds notarizations up to a very high standard. And without the mechanism of a notarization, without the mechanism of verifying a complaint under Rule 3AA, the system does not work. The system relies on the veracity of those who come before the court. And the court and opposing counsel need to be able to rely on the representations that are made to the court.
Does it make a difference when the dust settles, you find out that the person who signed the document was indeed the person identified to be the authorized signer of the document? There's no question that no forgery occurred here. There's no question that there was a misrepresentation about who was asserting the facts. It was indeed Mr. Bissonnier. So does that play into the analysis?
Your Honor, we submit that it is the process that we need to protect in this kind of situation. Even though Mr. Bissonnier may have signed those documents, there's no doubt that a misrepresentation was made. The documents on their face represented that Mr. Bissonnier had appeared in Philadelphia before the notary, and that was not the case.
I understand that, but it's not a misrepresentation that goes to the truth of what's asserted in the document.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is a misrepresentation about the checks that are put in place in the system to ensure that the true statements are being made.
Okay.
But those checks are very important, and without those checks, we submit that the process will not work.
That's why that prompts me to re-ask my original question, because now you've been careful, I think, to appropriately link it. How does that protection of the process play against allowing people to proceed to litigate on the merits of their cause?
With such a fundamental threshold issue as a complaint verification pursuant to Court of Chancery Rule 3AA, we submit that check, that fundamental threshold that a litigant must overcome in order to gain access to a court of equity like the Court of Chancery, these litigants asking for the aid of equity must come to the court with clean hands. They must come to the court and make true representations at that threshold point. So we believe that it's appropriate for the court not to even consider the merits.
But it's fair to say here, just to make sure I'm clear, that the true representation is not the facts asserted in the complaint, true or untrue, by a person who has knowledge of them and can assert those facts. The sole misrepresentation is that that person who has the facts and who can state those facts later under oath under other circumstances apart from the filing of the complaint, has knowledge of all those facts. It is that he did not appear before the notary who said she did see him.
And then caused a document to be filed with the court that represented that he had. And we believe that's very important because it is a misrepresentation on the face of the document.
I take your point on that.
Well, with regard to the merits, if this case goes back, what's the status of the board and the elections and everything else? Is that still a viable issue to be determined by the Court of Chancery, or has that become moot?
The annual meeting that was delayed because of the litigation ultimately took place on March 21st of this year. So any equitable relief that was sought respecting that meeting is now moot. The issue of the bylaw amendment and whether the board was correct to eliminate the board seat from Gail Page is not moot. It is that bylaw amendment is still in place.
So if it goes back and that seat is reinstated, then there'd be a vacancy on one seat?
Yes, Your Honor. There'd be, a Class 3 vacancy on the board. Turning to the issue of the fraud standard that the appellants now assert should apply in this case for the first time, it's interesting, the Postarivo decision is the one in which appellants say sets forth the standard that the court should adopt going forward. And a few things to say about the Postarivo case. One, it was decided before the Parkey decision that the appellants had claimed was the applicable standard before the court below. But the Postarivo standard also left open the possibility that Rule 41B motions aren't only for instances of fraud. So there could be a dismissal under Rule 41B for other abuses, and there's language in the opinion to that extent before the court engages in the fraud analysis. And we think that has to be the case. 41B has to be a flexible standard. It's, as we said in our papers, derived from the inherent power of the court to police the litigation process and address abuses on the docket. It coexists with that power, but it also is, it's encapsulated in the language of the rule. By requiring the court, or by saying that the court can only dismiss actions in the case of fraud, and if these six factors are met under the Postarivo standard, we're limiting the court's ability to redress problems, rule violations such as this one. And so we believe that cases like the Gebhardt case recognize that there is a real purpose for having the broad authority, the discretion of the court to look at litigation misconduct and decide whether a case should be allowed to go forward. The other case that was discussed by the appellants is the Perrone case, and that was also Vice Chancellor Parsons' case. And Vice Chancellor Parsons observed that he wasn't even sure that the fraud on the court argument that the pro se litigant was making in that action was even appropriately brought under Rule 41B. So it's a far cry from saying that Rule 41B motions must include a fraud analysis. As to the standard that we believe the court should apply, we think the language in the Parkey case is very clear, and it provides that appropriately flexible standard that the court can use. And the Vice Chancellor Noble discussed this standard on pages 4 and 5 of his opinion. And it's when the integrity, dismissal is appropriate when the integrity of the litigation process is fundamentally undermined by a party's lack of candor with the court. And we believe that's precisely what happened here. And we believe that Vice Chancellor Noble, who experienced proceedings along with us and who made a finding that there was a lack of candor with the court, is in a very good position to determine whether this case should be allowed to go forward or not.
What did he base the lack of candor conclusion on beyond the notary saying the person affirming these facts personally appeared before me?
It's not set forth explicitly in the opinion, but I think you can, looking at the kind of the surrounding discussions of the conduct of the individual parties, it's clear that it's the overall course of conduct of the parties that that led him to conclude that there was a lack of candor, starting with Mr. Bechenier's deposition, through the reaction of the plaintiffs to the request for discovery about the execution of the verifications. And on down, and also there's the underlying conduct, you know, where you had a foreign plaintiff asking a Pennsylvania lawyer to prepare a document that on its face had a misrepresentation. And the court found that I think all of those factors combined led the vice chancellor to find that there was a lack of candor with the court.
You made a general comment, but the only nut in the peanut butter I heard was a reaffirmation that the document itself had a false representation on it, namely that the affiant personally appeared before the notary. What I'm trying to get a better handle on, what are the other factors that combined with that allowed him to draw the conclusion that dismissal was the only appropriate remedy given the troubling conduct?
Your Honor, I go back to the response of the plaintiffs to the motion for additional discovery. Reticence to provide information about how these documents that were submitted to the court were prepared.
Okay.
I believe the court was troubled by the reaction of counsel.
You're talking about what could be characterized, and I think was in the earlier argument, as the court read it as a cavalier attitude toward the seriousness of the complaints verification process.
Yeah, the court had that reaction during the hearing on our motion for additional discovery on the verification issue. But also, the court evaluated the deposition testimony of Mr. Bechenier and Mr. Goggin and Ms. Bennett, and was invited to make a conclusion in the appellant's answering brief on the motion to dismiss as to credibility based on the videotapes that were submitted of those depositions. So to the extent the court made a credibility determination, it was something that the court was asked to do by the then plaintiffs. There's a footnote in their brief where I believe it's on footnote number 2 on page 3 where they asked the court to do that they could have asked for an evidentiary hearing.
Appellants today make an argument that when you actually look at what happened, it is a good faith mistake on the part of the notary and a mistake of understanding appropriate notarization under Pennsylvania law. Apparently, the Vice Chancellor would disagree that it was just a mistake and talks about troubling conduct, if not misconduct. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say, Your Honor. I think the takeaway from the Vice Chancellor's discussion of that conduct was that at the very least, the plaintiffs were reckless in the way that they executed the verifications. And I think if you add in the plain misrepresentation on the face of the document that they were not sworn to or subscribed before the notary, it takes it one step further. It's something that they did with knowledge, because there's not really any other way one can look at that document and believe that that is a correct representation. Going back to the point on the evidentiary hearing, it was raised in the appellant's papers that that they didn't have a hearing. And just a few points on that. First, the court ordered discovery on the specific issue of how these verifications were notarized. At those depositions, we asked questions of Mr. Goggin and Ms. Bennett, and the plaintiffs had an opportunity to make their record respecting their conduct as well. They did not ask questions of either deponent. The court then, we had a scheduling conference on the motion to dismiss, and the court said, I'm going to assume that this motion is going to be made on uncontested facts, but if that's wrong, you'll let me know. So the parties had an opportunity to ask for an evidentiary hearing, and the appellants didn't ask for a hearing. At the ultimate hearing on the motion to dismiss at argument, Mr. Goggin and Ms. Bennett were in attendance, and had there been questions that that the court had for them, or had there been something that that the plaintiff's counsel wanted them to testify about, I have no doubt that they would have been able to present that that testimony. Again, it was never requested of the court. So to now say that there was no evidentiary hearing and that somehow the conclusions should be construed against appellees with respect to any issues, we think is not taken well. In brief summary, Your Honor, we believe that the plaintiffs did violate a threshold requirement of chancery litigation, and in the court's discretion, it was found to undercut the integrity of the judicial process. And maintaining that integrity, we believe, is the standard that should apply in Rule 41B motions. So for these reasons, the Court of Chancery's dismissal of this action should be affirmed.
One question I know you're trying to close, but one question I meant to ask you earlier, what role would Rule 11 sanctions play in a scenario where the Vice Chancellor describes it as conduct that affects the integrity of the litigation process?
We considered Rule 11 in the context of our motion. The language of Rule 11 may be more applicable to the underlying allegations of the complaint as opposed to the kind of conduct that gave rise to this motion, which was the mechanism was not respected in connection with the complaint filing and submission of the verification. Now, there certainly is an argument to be made under Rule 11 that by submitting a document that has, you know, on its face that it was something that it was not, that it could give rise to Rule 11 sanctions. But we thought that that
including dismissal.
Potentially dismissal. I believe dismissal is potentially available under Rule 11.
But typically under a Rule 11 analysis, lesser sanction, forms of sanction would be at least discussed.
And we believe that the court did consider, the court certainly knew that it was possible to award a lesser sanction than dismissal. But this motion was made in the context of Rule 41B, which specifically discusses dismissal. And the court did discuss, as we pointed out in our papers, that it was possible and considered whether one or the other of the plaintiffs could be dismissed to allow the litigation to continue.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement to assess.